This is John Mark Reynolds for Middlebrow, a service of Scriptorium Daily and the Torrey Honors Institute here at Biola University. I get to host two of the brightest people on the planet, my usual compatriot.
Whoa, who's coming in today?
Paul, that's you, Teacher of the Year at Biola University, Provost Award winner Paul Spears. Paul, just before we do anything else, I'd like to congratulate you on that much-deserved award. We blogged about it, Fred Sanders and I. We're very proud of you. You're an outstanding teacher. You've been a good role model for me. Tell us a little bit about the award and what it meant to you to get it.
Well, I'd like to start by saying you like me. You really like me.
Yeah, it's great. Wait, Sally Fields.
Yeah.
Strong likeness, too.
Yeah, very much so.
You do not look like Sally Fields.
We got a very similar jib.
Can I call you Gidget?
No, you cannot.
Gidget. Wow. For those of you under the age of 60 in the audience.
How old are you?
Gidget.
Apparently 60.
You're supposed to be a young people. Matt Jensen, who will also be joining us. Fred and I were really excited, as were the other faculty. Just tell us a little bit about the award and really seriously what it felt like to get it.
Well, it's shocking. I think that my teaching has improved because of the people that I work with. And one of the things I like about our department is that we are continually enabling each other to be more effective.
Yeah, give us the official title of the award, Paul. I'm
going to
get it
no
out of
no idea. The Provost Award for Excellence in Teaching.
That means it doesn't come from Torrey, and this is a point I want to make to honor you. It doesn't come from Torrey. It doesn't come from your colleagues here. It's a recognition of people who don't work with you every day, that you're one of the best teachers at the university, certainly top 10%, because it's a award they give out every year, but don't give to people that don't deserve it. So that's just an outstanding honor.
As far as we know.
Yes, as far as we know. Are you the first? Are you the first?
I don't know.
If you get any more self-deprecating, we're going to have to put self-deprecation
to
through the digital martyrdom.
I am the teacher that everyone should model. I am the personification of teaching.
Keep going.
So okay, it's like,
going.
For those of you over the age of 60, Paul Spears is like Muhammad Ali. Also with me today, Matt Jensen.
Wow. And Gidget.
And Gidget.
That's a combination.
Because Ali.
Ali. If Muhammad Ali had married Gidget, Paul Spears
again,
would
you
be
know
their
what?
Child.
You've also dated yourself, because lots of people won't know who Muhammad Ali is.
That's what I said. For people over the age of 60, it was a reference. With us to be cool and part of the young
Somewhere
people.
Somewhere this congratulatory moment went sideways.
Yeah, it really did. Yeah. Is Matt Jensen, who is an awesome theologian, author of a new book on sin, Those Who Can't Teach. So does this mean you're utterly holy? Matt Jensen, say hello to your mother.
Hello to your mother.
Yeah, at least now the Jensens are listening. I actually met your parents
at a
fundraiser for another college, actually. And I think your mom and dad love you. It's amazing. They're amazingly proud of you.
They're good like that.
Yeah, they are good. They're very affirming. Anything other than my parents love me that you'd like to say to those out in radio land?
I love my parents, too. That's true. And my dad is turning 61, so he actually can make the Gidget jokes in good conscience.
Yeah, so, and Muhammad Ali jokes and Muhammad
right.
Ali marrying
that's right.
Gidget.
That's right.
Well, music is going through the digital martyrdom.
Oh, good. Thank heaven for moving forward.
Paul, yeah, please, get this. You know, of course, that my daughter will have quit listening now that we get serious. She only listens to the beginning of the show and then stops when we have deep things to say.
That might be not a bad idea.
No, it's really true. So, Paul Spears, music, what makes music good, true, and beautiful? Can we have that conversation? I know what music I like. But then, you know, I graduated from high school in 1981, college in 1986, took a year out, enforced year out during the college process. I could get stuck in the 80s easily. My liking something doesn't mean it's good, true, and beautiful. Can we talk about music as good, true, and beautiful?
Well, it's interesting because I think so many of us think that that music is only about taste. Sort of like if I go to the ice cream store and I decide whether I'm going to like chocolate or vanilla, and that those ideas about music are only predicated on my own personal likes and dislikes. But it seems like there really is something about the goodness or the badness of music, that you could talk about it in terms of the morality, the things that the music are saying, but you could also talk about it in terms of the abilities of individuals to do music properly. And I think that sometimes they become really conflated, and so when you listen to certain kinds of music, you think that is the best kind. So whatever music you grew up with, if it's, you know, Fred Sanders' favorite musical group, Journey. Right. And no, which is an absolute lie. He hates them with a passion.
Fred actually likes the Music Man song Shapoopy. So if you're listening out there and you can send Fred a copy of Music Man Shapoopy, he'll be greatly appreciative while he's on sabbatical. Please do this. We beg you, in fact, to send him a 99 cents on iTunes. Okay. Do you have anything to say about goodness, truth, and beauty, not just taste?
So I think that's the point. The question is, can it actually have a transcendence to it? Can things be transcendently good, true, and beautiful in the music world? And I think the answer is yes, but I think that it's easier not to reflect on something like this. And it's also important because I think our culture has driven us to just sort of take things as they are without a lot of reflection.
All right, let me give you an example, Matt Jensen, that really will date me. Hope and I actually like music that's from a generation before we could be alive, despite what I'm about to say. So I'm 45. I don't mind people knowing how old I am. But we like a lot of 60s tunes, and we really like Bing Crosby, for example, as one of the earlier crooners. So we listen to a fair amount of 40s music. But we know this. When we listen to, for whatever reason, the 60s boy band The Monkees works for us, and the Davy Jones and the song Girl, we've actually been to concerts where we're the youngest people in the audience.
How does that go, Girl?
I am. There is no chance whatsoever that I'm
going to do that. Nice try. I'm impressed.
Look what you've done to me.
Yeah.
Can you do Last Train to Clarksville for us, please?
Yeah, that's exactly right. Or,
and if we can talk at some point in this podcast about the Brady Bunch episode.
Where Davy Jones appears.
No, it's Marsha.
Marsha gets to take Davy Jones to the prom.
Even at 13, she's taller than
Yeah, Hope did watch that as a little kid. So that does fit our demographic. But here's the point. Hope, who's a classically trained trumpet player and knows good music, knows that that's not good music. It's okay. She just likes it. For whatever reason, it works for us. It makes us feel romantic in a certain kind of way. That's okay, but it's not good, true, and beautiful music. So what is good, true, and beautiful music? Or is my distinction not good? Where there's stuff we like just because of when we grew up and somehow we ran into that music, which is even before our time. It's certainly Bing Crosby. Right. Was not really alive when we started listening to pop music, yet his music works for us. We know it's not awesome. Live forever. What is the distinction?
And I think sometimes sometimes we like things and we'll say things like, that's the best blank ever, despite certain elements of goodness in it. So, I mean, I had this crazy soft spot, mainly because I grew up with him, listening to him, that is, for John Denver. Now, he actually has a beautiful
almost heaven,
voice.
West Virginia. Yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah, sure.
West Virginia, one of the best states in the Union.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Though the Shenandoah River is not in West Virginia. So, yeah, a little error, but West Virginians still like the song. That's anyway. Right.
It's the alliteration.
But we don't. Nice. I don't like John Denver because he has a beautiful natural voice, though one could argue that the most sort of beautiful or good, excellent, let's use the word excellent, the most excellent thing about John Denver's music is that he has a really quite impressive natural voice.
Elvis Presley is like that, but he isn't my taste.
Yeah.
So when I listen to Elvis Presley as a pop singer, I can say, wow, it's obvious why Elvis Presley got to be very famous, because he's got great natural pipes.
Yeah.
Untrained musician who is very good. I just, for whatever reason, don't like his music. It doesn't do it for me.
Another example I think of is White Christmas, which I love that as a movie. Now, I think they took about 6 months to rehearse it because of different funding issues. So it's incredibly tight. You can look at shot by shot, it's very, very tight. I don't like it because of the execution. I don't like it. I don't
Bing
even like
Crosby,
it because of the
Danny Kaye, Rosemary Clooney.
That's right. Vera Ellen.
Vera Ellen, great dancer.
A phenomenal dancer. But what I like it for is the mood. And I think the distinction, I think the sorts of things we like sometimes despite ourselves has much to do with mood. So Jeremy Begbie, in his recent book, Resounding Truth, he says that the dominant usage that we make of music these days is to make and manage moods.
That's a very good
almost
point.
Exclusively to make and manage moods. Whereas in times past, music was useful liturgically. It was the sort of thing that you play when you win battles. It's the sort of thing to call people to attention,
to arms,
to remind people to pray, to
celebrate
things.
The good, the true, and the beautiful don't matter. if it makes us feel like buying more popcorn because the soundtrack to Star Wars, anything by John Williams. John Williams, the greatest soundtrack writer ever, but the classically trained musicians I know have respect for him. But, you know, they when they have to do a Pops concert and play John Williams, they don't think, wow, this is the best thing we've ever played. Yeah. But he's maybe the best movie composer ever. Paul Spears, what makes music good, true, and beautiful? When I was a kid, there were pastors who said, backbeat is of Satan, so you could tell good music because it didn't have a backbeat.
What do you mean, they don't think that anymore?
No, as far
when,
as
when
I know.
When I was a kid, which was... more recently than John
Mark. A lot more recently than
junior
John
high, junior high, we had the same thing. If it's got a beat, it's of the devil, because it's got a beat, it makes you want to dance, it makes you want to have sex. And it was just sort
yeah,
of
yeah, see,
a,
in my church, it was reversed. Nice. It's That's it right. all led to dancing, right. and that was the real
which
problem.
Which is why premarital sex is wrong. So listening in, don't dance.
Don't dance.
Unless you're married, and then you can dance all you want.
Paul Spears, can you save us from this general insanity? What is good music? Or can we not define it? Should we have brought a musician in to do that?
Well, no, I think that there's a certain sense of technical ability, but there's also a sense of when one plays well, when one also plays soulishly.
Yes.
In other words, that you can't just be a technician. There's something about the thing that you bring to the stage that is evocative to the other people that are participating. But I also think...
Okay, so let me say, my suggestion has been, it's incarnational mathematics. Good, true, and beautiful music, with the stress on the incarnational, because it's human beings who are playing
this
beautiful
relational.
Mathematical thing.
Right,
yeah.
So I think I would push on the fact that when human beings, through whatever medium, are communicating with each other in a relational manner, that's the thing that makes it good. So you could have computers play technically well, and that's not going to be the same thing as watching Yo-Yo Ma in a concert and experiencing his passion
yes.
for the music that comes through your not just watching him. There is a mood that is set when
this
he
drives
plays.
My wife nuts. I think what we all have to agree is live concerts are pretty much dead. Mm-hmm. Hope and I will go to Steamers every once in a while. I am 45.
Which is a jazz club.
It's a jazz club here in Fullerton, and we'll still be below the median age of people there. A few college kids, but you know, if you did a median, it's more like 50s and 60s. In there, and I don't think it's because of the venue. I just think
it's the $15 cover charge.
Yeah, that's true. But I don't think people go to live music anymore. That's not a particularly expensive ticket. Look at movie theaters.
Concerts are dying. Is that due to the size of the venue? So when people are playing in at the Nokia, you know, stadium or something, when a small venue is 2,500 people where you need binoculars to see the performer...
Well, sure.
That's part of it,
right? We went to see Paul McCartney, and you know, there were all age people there, from really little kids to cool people. Where we were sitting, you had to be careful not to breathe too deeply or you would get high. Yeah. Funny thing, the cops started up the stairs, and I thought, oh, man, these people are going to get busted for their pot use. They grabbed the hidden camera that they were using to tape the show and basically hauled them out while the people near them smoking away were left alone. So I thought that was funny. But yeah, you pay $60, and somebody gave us tickets in this case as a very generous gift. But when you pay $60 to sit in the back of a giant auditorium, it better be a big show. That kind of concert obviously hasn't died. But I'm talking about live music and small intimate things, kind of like live theater. It's in deep doo-doo. Why is that? Why do you think... Any musician would say canned music, any kind of recorded music, it's what Paul Spears just said, not so great.
Well, and I think part of it, if Baby's right, if music really is about mood, if that's the way we think of it, and I think that is largely the case, then if all I want is to feel a certain way, I can do that really easily with any kind of digital music. I know just the songs to put on, I can make a mixed album. And so if the way I interact with music is in terms of how it makes me feel, that I can get.
I wonder if this is another question about media, too, and the fact that it's now music is ubiquitous. It's everywhere. We can get it at all points in our day. And so I think it's two things. It's one, it's the opportunity, which changes the way we think of it. But I also think that it's the fact that we also use it to hide. Mm-hmm. And so that when my students will walk into my classroom, they will have their iPod going. They'll throw it, and then right before class starts, they'll take it out. And then,
if you're lucky,
that's right.
Well, yeah, and then they'll put it right back on or go right to their phone, you know, right when they go. And there's a sense of hiding from your own person through the medium of the delivery of the music.
Okay, but the temptation is to start sounding like, get off the grass, kind of people.
Right.
So here's what's bad about music.
Wait, grass, what here's, do you mean by that?
Yeah, well, given well, the last story, we don't know.
As long as I'm not stealing intellectual property, it's okay.
Then it's okay. Let's. Wow. How should music, Paul Spears, Matt Jensen, how should music be used? What is music, and what should we be doing with our lives? We know what we shouldn't do.
I think that when music is participatory and multifaceted way. So the other day, I can't even remember what was playing. It was a U2 song in our house, and my daughter and I danced around the room. And I think that it evoked joy, and we participated not just in the song in some sort of abstract way, but we actually participated in the song when I was dancing around the room too. I think It's a Beautiful Day, if I remember correctly.
So I love that, Paul, because the music wasn't live, but your experience of the music was live because you were doing it in a community, namely you and Lexi, who is so dramatically talented.
Well, and Ian was looking at us like, I think I might like to participate, but I'm 11 and much too mature for that.
Matt Jensen, what's good about music? How should we be using it?
Well, and by the way, I think it's perfectly fine to use it for entertainment and for that matter, to make and manage moods. So I don't think, I think that's a perfectly fine
thing. Do you go to clubs and listen to music?
On occasion, yeah. But although I will say that the concerts
don't you know someone that's musically inclined?
My sister, Molly Jensen, mollyjensen.com.
I will tell you right now, Molly Jensen, you should go buy the CD. Molly Jensen does it right.
And she does live good.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. Hopefully, eventually, we'll be able to have her come to Torrey and do a concert for us. No kidding. You know,
Before she gets famous and doesn't remember us.
You know, there was a point before Keith Green was famous and everybody wished they knew him. And Molly Jensen, it's a good time to get to know what I think is really a rising star in the area of, I would say, pop music in general, not Christian pop music.
Yeah, yeah, no, she's a singer-songwriter and doing really good work.
Yeah. And somehow doesn't look like you, which is probably the greatest blessing.
That is absolutely
the greatest blessing ever.
That's right.
Go ahead, Matt. How else can we use music
I mean, you're asking about live music. I see live music, but not a lot. And I listen to music a ton. And I'm thinking about music all the time, and I'm sharing music. It's what's interesting to me, actually, is the way that digitized music can be a source of community, too. I've got a couple students who have given me mixes of songs, which sort of says something about who they are, the sort of thing they like. I have all the time am talking with music about students, and it's almost always music that none of us have heard live.
Yes.
And so I think it'd be a mistake to think that live music sort of guarantees relationship in a way that canned music doesn't.
Can you help me think about the notion of or the expectation of perfection? Yeah, because when you get recorded music, right, there's this very tightly engineered piece of instrumentation with the vocals and the way the tracks are laid on top of each other, and it's really a science.
Right.
And how do you think that that's different from the live piece? Because the expectation, so if somebody hits a bad note or if something doesn't go quite right.
Well, Molly actually sings at her concert as opposed to now the famous YouTube of Britney actually singing versus what you hear, where they, you know, she just is always to a digital, she's always lip syncing. And I'm not even putting that down. People know when they go to a Britney concert, they're getting Britney lip syncing.
Right? Mostly when we all go out to speak, we're just lip syncing our talk.
Yeah, that's exactly.
And by the way, if Britney was a singer, like, she was a good singer, and if people go to see her dance, see the spectacle, and so, and actually there's a sense in which, though I have zero affection for her music, that doesn't trouble me as much
as it doesn't
if I were to go to the opera, if I were to go even just to someone whose voice is what I'm going for, that's
a
problem. There's an off, like Katie Van Coten, also an alum of Toriano Institute.
Well, I do think of Phil Ijen, who's put together, and we've actually, you can go into Scriptorium and see Phil's CD, because it's worth buying. But seeing Phil live is a different experience than buying a Phil Ijen CD. Talking to Josh Sikora live, however, is better than watching a Josh Sikora movie, partly because people are always more interested than even their artwork. Would you rather go see the David or get to talk to Michelangelo? Now, the David is my favorite work of art ever, so that's actually a hard question for me. But I think fundamentally, not just because he's dead and it would be amazing to get to talk to him, though evil, Michelangelo is always going to be more interesting
than
his work.
There's no Witch of Endor.
Because the work came out of him, right? It was produced. Maybe. But then, you know, part of me wants to hop on the other side. Here's the point. We've only started talking about music because, as Plato would say, if he were here, if we could do the Witch of Endor thing that Paul Spears is talking about, he'd say, music, it may be the most important part of our education. Well, this has been John Mark Reynolds, Paul Spears, Matt Jensen, for Middlebrow, a service of Scriptorium Daily, where today, just barely, and with some discussion of Paul, Teacher of the Year here at Biola, big ideas have undergone the digital martyrdom.